up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, joined here, as always, by my co-host, Canucks insider Thomas Drantz, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We are efforting to get Elias Pettersson's agent, Pat Brisson, on the phone right off the top of the show here. So hopefully we'll be able to connect with Pat momentarily because, as you might have heard by now, some pretty big news for one of his clients, Elias Pettersson, signing the 8-year deal with the Canucks over the weekend, which, of course, we covered on our emergency podcast on Saturday. But this is a big one, so we'll talk about it a little bit here as well, Trancer.
Will we?
I mean, I think so.
We'll talk about it with Pat.
Yeah.
And then I think we'll kind of move on to deadline shenanigans of the game against Anaheim last night. I mean, that's what's so interesting about this sport, about pro sports in general. Life moves fast.
It does, but
after months of discussion, we will move on after one emergency podcast.
The thing is, the Elias Pettersson contract ties into the deadline, ties into kind of what to expect
slightly
from the team down the stretch.
Slightly.
Right? So it's still, and you know, look, when it's news that big, you know, you need some time to digest, to look back and all that.
Oh, yeah. But, have you significantly altered your feelings?
Yeah, now
about...
I hate it. Hot take here. What are they doing? No, it's still a home run. Still a home run for the Canucks. But yeah, we will get Pat Brisson on the phone here momentarily to get some more details about how it unfolded, Elias Pettersson's view on things. I'm really curious to ask about the 8-year term after we'd heard a lot of different numbers reported at different points. So we'll talk to Pat Brisson about this, about that. At 12:30, Dom Lucision from The Athletic.
Dun, dun,
yes,
dun.
The villain. Evil Dom, as he's referred to in the Canucks Talk group chat, to distinguish him from our producer, Dom Germatti, who's also pretty evil.
Yeah, I mean,
to be fair, like, I don't really know what a distinction that is, but
evil and eviler.
I'm the one that produces 32 songs.
That's right. Yes, that's correct. Dom Lucision will join us at 12:30. So we'll bump the whiteboard for later on in the show.
Maybe it should be 32 Dom and 3B Dom. That would help us out.
I like that. 32 Thoughts Dom and 3B Dom, which he'll forever be known as 3B, the 3B guy here in Vancouver. Quickly, before we do get Pat Brisson on the phone here. So, yeah, the Canucks have played a game since the big Elias Pettersson contract. They beat the Ducks 2-1. A bit of a snooze fest, I think it's fair to say, in Anaheim yesterday. But, hey, you get the 2 points.
A convincing narrow win. You know, I don't think we need to spend too much more time on it than that. At least there was no suspense in the mother of all get right spots. And, you know, I've actually got some pretty detailed thoughts on the game. We're going to do the whiteboard at 1:30, segment 4. We've got an open segment, segment 3. I think there's going to be a lot of Ducks Canucks reaction at 1 p.m. And also, I think we'll get into some Gensel stuff.
We'll get into some trade deadline stuff because it's deadline week now, right? Like, we're just a few days away from seeing how this team takes shape at the trade deadline, and we can talk about that later on in the show. But as mentioned, right now we are very pleased to be joined on the line. He is one of Elias Pettersson's agents. He is Pat Brisson. Pat, thank you very much for making time for us today. How are you? And first of all, congratulations to you and your client on the big new deal signed over the weekend.
Thank you, Jamie. Thanks, Tom. I mean, it was an exciting moment, and we're glad that it got done, and especially during this busy period with the trade deadline coming up. We have so many other moving parts, you know, till Friday. So it was good to, thanks, you appreciate it. It was good to get it done for sure.
Pat, can you give us a sense of what the past week has been for you and for your client leading up to Saturday's big announcement?
These discussions started probably right around the draft in Nashville last June, and let's not forget that Pitty was a potential RFA, had another year left after this year as a before becoming UFA, and at no point he had any intention of leaving Vancouver. So, but he wanted to take his time, which is fair. Normally, players in his situation, those deals are normally done either at the end of their current contracts and because they're not UFA. So usually we kind of wait, and he was fine. That's what he wanted to do. And but then the talks became more extensive, perhaps, the past 2 weeks as Jim and Patrick elaborated clearly to us that they would like to get this done sooner the better in order to continue to build the puzzle. And EDS understood that and understood where the Canucks were going, and it meant a lot for them and for him. If you're going to be part of this important puzzle there, you can help us by getting it done now, so we know getting to the trade deadline prior to July 1st, also in the draft, it gives us more time to really, you know, continue building this thing around you and some of the core players.
Pat's been reported, The Athletic, Sportsnet, a variety of places, that, you know, there was a meeting between Jim and Patrick and Elias earlier this week in which, you know, they just discussed why not now, given that we are all comfortable with where this is trending ahead of the deadline. When one of your clients is in a spot like Elias, franchise caliber guy, and, you know, they're going to go into a meeting with management like that, how do you prepare? What are the sort of the priorities from an agent side on preparing a player for that pitch?
Well, you want to make sure, first of all, that your client is ready. And depending on the circumstances or the situation going in or the subject, you want to make sure that he's 100% ready. So there's so many different situations where management is meeting directly with players for all types of reasons. So in this case, it was fair for Jim and Patrick to elaborate their plan. We've done that a few times throughout the process, and most recently they had another meeting with him. And just it's all about communication, and sometimes it's good to let the management having these conversations directly with the player. A lot of times I'm involved. I'm either there with them, or in this case, not that I needed to be on the phone or conference call. I mean, we went over the subject and the pieces that they were going to talk to him about. And I trust the Jim and Patrick that they went accordingly. And that's how they did it. And just basically expressing to Pitty, you know, their plan. And and it was, for such an important decision, it's important for the player to I believe to go through it and make sure to absorb it.
You know, you talk about the trust between the player and management, Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin, Pat, and, you know, we had heard from Elias Pettersson before the season, right? I want to see how this season goes, how we perform as a team. We've heard also other times in his career that winning is so important to him. How important was it for Pettersson to see kind of, you know, not just hear from management that they have a certain vision for the team, but see it play out on the ice in a really successful manner so far with the Canucks this season?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I don't think we're having these types of conversations, last 2 weeks if the team is going south and going the wrong direction, perhaps. So the momentum that's been built in the last 6 to 8 months, or even started last year, was also encouraging for EDS to make the decision. And so that was part of the decision of signing with the Canucks. See, there's lots of teams that are going in the right direction too, and we can say during summertime, well, you know, this team or that team or that team will do well this year, they're going to do this and that, and then less than 6 months later you realize the opposite. So it's important to go through the process and to go through it, and it was very encouraging to see that the Canucks continue to get better, and for Pitty to obviously make his decision much easier that way.
Pat, one of the things that struck me immediately seeing the news of the contract was that it was for the full 8 years, the max term available on the extension. Was that always something that appealed to Elias Pettersson? Were there other lengths of contract discussed? How did he land on signing up for that full 8-year term?
Yeah, every time we explore a new contract extension or contract itself, depending on the type of options that the player has, including leverage. I mean, you look at a player like Elias, I mean, he's 25 going on 26 when his next season starts. So if you do a 5-year deal, which we could have explored as well, he's up at 31. And you obviously would have gotten lower AAV on a 5-year deal. So the question becomes, do you want 5 years for about 55, or you want to explore 8 years for $93 million? It's a $38 million delta. And the question you have to ask yourself, are you going to sign a 3-year deal at age 31, 32, 33 that's going to be exceeding $38 to $40 million guaranteed? That's not certain either. So you get that guaranteed money coming to you, and that way you have that guaranteed. So the alternative, if you go 5 years, which you could have gone 5 years, you have your options sooner to extend, but at that time you may not be a $15 or $16 million player even if the cap goes up. So we explored everything with him, and he thought it made sense, and that's how we ended up on an 8-year deal.
Pat, as I'm sure you know, very passionate fans, very passionate marketplace here in Vancouver, and there had been an awful lot of discussion, especially really over the last week or 10 days or so before Elias Pettersson signed this contract. And we had even heard from Pettersson himself in a couple of interviews and from Rick Tocchet saying, yeah, you know, Petey hears the noise and maybe it is starting to weigh on him, and he's trying to deal with it and push through it. Did that noise and the sense that maybe it was becoming a distraction for the player and the team help push Pettersson to say, you know what, let's get this deal done now?
I'm not so sure. I mean, the distractions, I mean, when the player doesn't perform as well, we always try to find reasons what's going on with him or the team. And teams go through cycles as well. I mean, everything is cyclical. I mean, you don't want to be in the dip too long, but I think it's healthy to, you can't be going up all the time. Sometimes the adversity is a good thing throughout the year in order to prepare for the playoffs. Not that you plant that seed into your calendar, but same time, I don't think it had anything to do with that. It was basically clear, from the team standpoint, that they really wanted to express to us the importance of keeping Petey as an asset, because it's going to help them through this trade deadline to acquire or to whatever, do what they have to do. Now they know where he's at going forward. And only that, it's going to help them go into the summer as well in advance, instead of waiting till June 28th or 29th and then pass the draft to see it. Those are big chips, and those are big parts of the puzzle, and it's better to get them solidified sooner the better. And that the timing of it was basically the process that we went through, and then maybe the trade deadline and all that. And I know there were a bunch of rumors around the league and all that, but we didn't sweat on those.
Pat, one of the most fascinating trends for players and their agents over the past 5 or 6 years has been sort of a blurring of the lines between unrestricted and restricted free agency, especially with the size and length that we're seeing of some second contracts. Now, though, it feels like the last couple of summers, we're also seeing a blurring of the lines between sort of UFA and RFA with concepts of team control and how players can use their leverage, even with a year remaining ahead of unrestricted free agency, to, you know, call their shot in terms of moving teams. How much are you aware, just in general, but obviously in Pettersson's case as well, of how teams are thinking of this concept and sort of managing their risk a bit differently than they have in years past?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you recall, but geez, in 2004, mm-hmm. Before the cap was established, free agency was, I think, 31 years old.
Right.
And I remember that day when this came came about, you know, with a cap system, free agency went to 27 or 7 years of services. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the game now. It's all part of the business. If we had a non-cap system and perhaps free agency would be at 30, 31 years old again, and then things would be different. Now teams have to be aware that players have more leverage at a certain point, quicker into mm-hmm. their career, since there's a cap, you know, a cap on salaries, and therefore they have the leverage at one point, some of them, to decide to go where they want to go and extend whatever they want. It's part of the system. And the player has a year left on his contract, and he's a UFA the following year. And he does have leverage. Not everyone has leverage. You see, we always right. see the case as a player who do look good and have the leverage, and then we put so much emphasis on this, but we forget a lot of the players who don't have the leverage. It's probably 95% of the players don't have the leverage. And the ones who do, they should exercise it and make a decision. It's such a choice to sign an extension or to go to the market they want to. And that's concept that was sold back in the days,
right?
That put a cap system in place. There's going to be a lot more movement within the system, and that's what we're dealing with right now.
And have you noticed any change in terms of players who are RFAs, like 1 year away from unrestricted free agency, sort of in the wake of what we consider to be the Tkachuk precedent from teams? Has that changed sort of the urgency with which teams approach players in that sort of stage of their career?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it now. I mean, mm-hmm. Like I said, with Vancouver, I mean, it was important to them to hopefully try to get an answer from us.
Right.
The sooner the better, but we're happy here. Pitty was very happy in where the team is going, but if they were fighting for a wild card or let's say way below, who knows how the conversation would have gone. I don't know. Like, see, that's so teams have to evaluate also where they're at in their process, and that's why teams are going to have to evaluate also whether to sign an asset longer when they're out of entry level and kind of tie them up. But also, you don't know what that asset's going to become a lot of times. So it's a little bit of a gamble. You can't give 8-year deals to all your entry level players either. So that's why it's a complicated game. And that's why there's only one team winning the cup. And there's 31 other teams unhappy.
Every summer. Pat, thanks so much for your time and your insight. I just want to ask you one more because it's trade deadline week. And for us as Sports Talk Radio hosts and our listeners, that's an exciting time filled with, you know, hope and potential prospects and dreams of a long playoff run. But within the business, for your clients, for their families, obviously it's a nerve-wracking week. And in addition to having a, you know, massive roster of NHL star clients, you're also a hockey dad. You have more information in terms of managing that sort of anxiety than your average hockey dad. But nonetheless, is this week an unnerving one for you, especially given that your son Brendan's a young player in a contending organization?
Obviously I'm a dad first. And I'm emotional like any other dad. And when I watch my son's play and what he does and what he's going to do or, you know, all that stuff. I mean, that's first and foremost. And I try to hopefully at times stay in my lane, which it's not easy for anyone. If you're a good parent, you know, we care about our kids. So, but at the same time, it gives me a different perspective on things about what players are going through sometimes. And I think it got me to be better as an agent because I understand players perhaps better and parents over the years. Both Jim Hughes and I go way back. I mean, we spend a lot of times with our kids. I mean, he's got 3 kids in the NHL. And we spend a lot of time with our player development and where we're going with it in our business, and we can see firsthand what players are going through our kids too. I mean, to answer your question, it's sometimes a double whammy. You know, we got the anxiety and the excitement of what's going on with your clients and the uncertainties, and then you have your own kids in the mix. So It's a little crazy sometimes, for sure.
Pat, we really appreciate you spending some time with us, and congratulations again on the deal. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
That is Pat Brisson from CAA, Elias Pettersson's agent, weighing in on the new 8-year deal for his client. And as you said, also some of the trends in the NHL as it pertains to RFAs and also his son, which, yeah, as a potential prime trade asset for the Vegas Golden Knights. I mean, could he be playing with one of his dad's? I guess his dad's most famous client, Sidney Crosby, in Pittsburgh soon.
I was preparing for the roundup and looking over Vegas trade assets, and I was like, prepping for an interview and prepping for some trade assets, and some similar names are coming up. I best ask. It's going to be an interesting week for the Canucks. It's going to be an interesting week for the entire league, and you can, you know, rest assured based off of Brisson's many clients and CAA's many clients that, you know, there's going to be a lot to manage on his end as well over the course of this week, even with the big Elias Pettersson deal out of the way.
The Tkachuk thing is so fascinating, too, because he's absolutely right. The vast majority of RFAs are never in a position to do anything like that.
No.
They don't have anything close to the type of leverage. So most of the time, it doesn't matter at all. But in those other cases, it matters a lot, as we saw, and we, you know, in the reporting, I know that you and Rick Dhaliwal did, and other reports, it mattered a lot from the Canucks management perspective.
Rutherford and Brisson specifically were discussing the matter. I mean, the Canucks, it was top of mind for the Canucks, not as a, and it's really important, too, to note this, right? Not as a thing that they were worried about. They were always confident that Pettersson wanted to be a Vancouver Canuck. But you always have to manage your risk, right? And that's what top executives are paid to do. And the Canucks were conscious of the risk posed by the Tkachuk precedent, which played out last summer with DeBrincat and Dubois, and which we'll probably see play out again this year. Again, slowly but surely, as this is, you know, as the hard cap era has sort of inaugurated a younger league, right? And the league gets faster and faster every year, and rosters get younger and younger, and contributors get younger and younger. Entry-level deals are at such a premium. You know, guys like Tarasenko, the moment they hit 28, become like journeymen, right? I mean, it's a tough league, especially for older players now, an increasing emphasis on youth. And, you know, within that context, I think teams have to be really careful about the timelines that they adhere to, just like how over time the Justin Schultz precedent caused teams to pull their college players out, put on that full court press to sign them following their sophomore year to avoid the risk. Managing risk, that's what this is about now, and it's really characterizing the situation for players in Pettersson's boat, and it was a really significant shaping influence in the conversations between both sides, both over the course of the year and the conversation between player and executives last week that stimulated a resolution.
We will take a break. Dom Lucision from The Athletic joins us. Dom, the Dom of Dom's Model joins us next year on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hitting the most important topics for Vancouver sports fans. The People's Show with Vic Nizar. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650, your home of the Canucks. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Busy show today. Thank you to Pat Brisson joining us in the first segment. And we've got another guest coming up here. The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call. We now go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline, where we are joined from The Athletic by Dom Lucision. Dom, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Good. How are you?
We're doing well.
Wait, is Dom at The Athletic? You presented it like it was a location.
I'm from The Athletic.
On location at The Athletic.
That's
Dom
what I
Lucision.
Always say. What do you want me to say?
I don't know. Anyway, Dom, how are you, my friend? Thanks for joining us. Need to get your take on the value of the Pettersson deal, especially given that your model is actually able to project that value out over the length of the contract?
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty fair deal. It seems as if a lot of people felt Pettersson left money on the table, and I don't totally disagree, but I'm a bit more conservative on his total value. I have it right now over the next 8 years at $11.9 million on average, which is a phenomenal player. He's one of the best in the world. I think there is some upside on whether he plays a bit more, gets above that 20-minute range, and consistently gets above 100 points. I know he, I think, hit that last year and is on pace this year. I think at 11.5, the expectation is a 95-point player. The higher he is above that consistently throughout his contract, the more value he brings to the Canucks. And obviously he does other things on top of that, the small things that make him a pretty strong player overall, where he drives play and he creates chances, and it's not just the point totals. I think the sticking point for me is, as much as I like Pettersson, I don't see it as this huge win where he's a $13 or $14 million player. I think that he did pretty well in this deal, even if he probably could have got more.
Mm. What kind of risk, if any? I mean, there's always a little bit of risk, but it is an 8-year deal. And, you know, even with a player of Elias Pettersson's stature, I mean, how much risk is there as he gets into his 30s on this contract, in your view?
I mean, that's in what, like 5 years? I feel like the risk there is very muted. I think he's a smart player and he's an elite player, and those types of guys can last pretty long. There are obviously some exceptions to the rule where there can be a quick drop off and suddenly he's not looking so hot, but I don't really see that happening for him, because I mean, he's not the best skater and he's doesn't need that to thrive the way he has. I think he is a smart player, and that I think makes him less prone to that sort of sudden drop off. I think he can adapt if necessary and bring the kind of value that is required for such a big contract. And obviously the age is a big deal. Being 25, he should be fine.
With the Pettersson deal done for the Canucks, at least some of their attention will turn to their other key expiring contracts. And one of the guys, or in fact, the signature guy remaining, whose number is going to be absolutely fascinating given his usage this season, given his production this season, is Filip Hronek. Now, the most recently updated player card at The Athletic has Hronek, you know, providing $8.3 million worth of market value. How does your model tease out Hronik's individual contributions, given the amount of time he spends with Quinn Hughes, one of the best individual defensemen in the league, according to your model this year?
Yeah, he's a very, very tricky player to suss out. I'm in the process of working on adjustments for a competition and especially teammates that can hopefully provide a clear look, and I'm sure you will beg me for the data
yep.
at some point over the next month to write
sorry,
about it.
I already sent the Slack message.
Yeah, there you go. So that'll come once I figure all of that out. But for now, you got to think that at least some of that $8 million value is a product of playing with Hughes. At the same time, they're the types of players who can help bring out the best in those guys, and it's possible that the Canucks see Hronek as sort of a Devon Taves type. I don't personally think he's as good, and getting Hronek around the same price range would, to me, not feel ideal. But when it comes to the numbers he puts up with Hughes, as great as Hughes is, it's not all Hughes. He wasn't putting up these numbers with other partners, and obviously the other partners include Luke Shen and several other replacement-level defenders. Having a solid number two or solid number three, which I think Hronek is, has allowed Hughes to really find this game this year, where he's become someone who's exploded into the stratosphere of literally the MVP conversation. He's been that good. And I don't want to completely puts, I guess, credit on either side. I think they've both helped each other, and obviously Hughes has helped more, but I don't want to take anything away from Hronek being that kind of presence beside him. That's helped stabilize the pair.
On Quinn Hughes, as you mentioned, you know, potentially even in the Hart conversation, I know the betting markets for the Norris show that he is the heavy, heavy favorite over Cale Makar at this point. Is that justified in your view? Should Quinn Hughes be looked at as, you know, almost the prohibitive favorite to win the Norris right now?
Yeah, I think I want it to be known that I'm pretty consistent with how I look at these things. So in past years, I have loved Cale Makar for the Norris. I haven't liked Hughes as much. And it stems from there may not be a huge difference by their point totals, or maybe there wasn't last year, but their underlying metrics past years, Colorado did so well with Makar on the ice, and he was obviously transcendent anytime you watched him. With Hughes last year or years past, he wasn't at that same level. So that's sort of the barometer I usually go by for the Norris, where yes, it's nice that they're scoring a lot of points. They look close there, but Makar has always had that other extra gear, and especially defensively, he's been so strong. This year, I don't know what is going on with Makar, but I think it's a really interesting thing that he plays like 70, 80% of his minutes with MacKinnon, which is unheard of for a defenseman. He gets a treasure trove of offensive zone starts. And at 5-on-5, the Colorado Avalanche are even with him on the ice. I don't think that's entirely on him. He's obviously Makar, fantastic player. But his situation could not be easier, even if he's playing tough minutes. He's playing with an MVP candidate. He's playing with Rantanen as well. He's playing with a strong partner. To have those kind of results at 5-on-5, it doesn't make me feel comfortable picking him as the Norris winner, let alone even one of the top three at this point. I just don't think he has had his signature kind of season. He was certainly there at the start, but I think when he got injured, might have been December, once he came back from that, he has looked completely different, at least analytically.
Let's talk Pacific Division wider angle lens. And just to give our audience a bit of insight, by the way, into the fact that some of us stats-friendly guys still can look at the same data and disagree. You and I have had a long disagreement over the course of the season, including a friendly wager, over the quality of the LA Kings. You have an LA Kings fade position. I'm in on the Kings. I like to ask our guests to give me their tiers to tier the Pacific Division. Can I ask you to do so, and you can safely ignore both the Ducks and the Sharks in so doing?
Yeah, I obviously did this with you over Slack. What was our bet again? Was it 100 points? Or
it was whatever the over-under was set at. And the stakes are dinner in Vegas, so.
It's looking tight right now.
Yeah, it's going to be close.
Tight.
It's going to be close. I think it's 96.5, though. Like, I think I'm going to be saved by a low line.
Oh, no, I was that low. I'm pretty sure the Vegas over-under was at 100.5 or something like that. So It's starting to look tight in that regard. We'll see what additions they make. But for me, I think Edmonton is the team to be in the Pacific. They have the best player in the world. Their decor looks better than usual, even though they're still not where they need to be. Stuart Skinner has sort of found his game, and they also have Draisaitl. They have strong forwards. I can't really bet against the Oilers right now. After that, I think you can make an argument for any of Vancouver, LA, Vegas to be your 2, 3, or 4. I think they're all relatively close and they all have their own strengths. I would take Vegas first out of that tier. And then after that, the argument we've always had is who's better between Vancouver and LA. And I would take Vancouver, especially in a playoff series. I think the star power that they have, especially the huge advantage in net, will give them an edge. And I think the Kings have shown over the last 2 years, obviously against a better team, that the star power edge is a big deal that they just don't have. And they went out of their way last summer to, I guess, create that edge for them by getting Dubois. And we've seen how that's worked out this year, where Dubois has looked more like a third line player. And it's been a really uneven season for the Kings. I mean, they've they're where they are because of a lot of loser points, and I don't see them as a real contender, and I think the Canucks are definitely a bit better.
Dom, appreciate the time, man. Thanks for doing this. You're a regular character here on the show, even when you're not on the phone with us.
As
so
he knows.
We appreciate it.
I'm free anytime to come along and talk about the things we talk about on Slack.
Thank you, Dom.
Thanks,
appreciate
my friend.
It. That is Dom Lucision from The Athletic. And there you go. The Canucks, real contenders, unlike the LA Kings.
Yeah,
he's
no.
doing his best to rehab the image here on Vancouver Radio, Dom Lucision.
Dom's had a very, very strong fade position, and although it's lost to history, Dom's model was way higher, like by a magnitude of 5 or 6 points in terms of his projection of the Canucks than every other publicly available model. Right? Like, the Canucks are one of the biggest misses from a log loss perspective on all publicly available models, including, by the way, Vegas, right? Which had them at a 3.5 over under. They're going to hit that in what, a week, 2 weeks, depending on when this losing streak ends or this sort of bump in the road. I guess it's not a losing streak, but you know, what, 2-5-1 in their last 9 or 8.
Yep.
So, you know, anyway, Dom's been way higher than the Canucks than market throughout this process. He has some very early Canucks to win the Pacific Division shares, like on and on. And I've actually been a little bit lower than him pretty consistently over the course of the season and far higher on the Kings. I just don't buy that the goaltending matters when you play defense like LA.
Yeah, but if you're talking about a Canucks-LA matchup, I can buy that because we've seen the Canucks struggle to break down those blue lines.
Yeah.
But I don't think LA is going all the way to the cup and no one's going to break them down. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if they're like, oh, well, they'll just shut down McDavid and Draisaitl.
No, but it's not like they're playing with an empty net. Like, Cam Talbot's not chopped liver, necessarily.
No, but it's a risk.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
I just don't think you can wave it away.
But so is every goaltender in the league. Like, Sergei Bobrovsky can get hot at the right time after being one of the most, you know, sub-average starters to get as much run as he's got over 5 years. He can turn on the Jets and destroy it. Vasilevsky can lose a series to some combination of Joseph Woll and who's the guy that they had, the Russian guy? Samsonov. You know, I just think people overrate their ability to predict which goaltender is going to outperform another one at the NHL level over a 7-game stretch.
Sure, but it's still, again, that's if you're talking
Aiden
about
Hill, Jake Ottinger.
If you're talking about a one playoff series window, that's certainly true. But if you're looking at trying to be a Stanley Cup contender, I think it's a ticking time bomb if you have really substandard goaltending, right? You can mitigate it.
But I wouldn't say they do. They haven't this season.
But I just think, like, I don't think just because they are a good defensive team that you can, you know, it means you don't have to be concerned about the goaltending.
Well,
right?
But I mean, I just don't see the reason to be concerned about the goaltending.
That's fair.
Based
that's
off
different.
Of, I just think we're way too confident. And this was my argument to Dom, too. Dom was like, yeah, sure, I'm okay with teams going zero goalie. I don't like how the Kings did it. And I said, you don't know. Like, you can't pick Raheem Mostert reliably from, I don't know, some guy
whoever.
Who sucks.
Yeah.
Jerick McKinnon. You know, like, you're lying to yourself.
Yeah, that's fair, but it doesn't mean there's no risk there.
No,
right?
Of course, but that doesn't mean there's no risk with, like, Cam Talbot has a save percentage 0.009 points higher than Igor Shesterkin. Right? Andre Vasilevsky is like sub-900 this year. You know?
Yeah, goaltending's unpredictable, but there's not.
There's risk on
zero,
the great goalies, too.
Sure, but less. There is. Of course there is.
I mean, just not by nearly as much as you expect.
It might be smaller than people think, but it is still meaningful.
See, the problem is that in saying that, you're underrating the risk of the sure bet and overrating the risk on the low bet. That's the point.
No, but if you had your choice going into playoff series, you know exactly who you'd choose. Right?
Between Demko and Cam Talbot?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Of course you do.
Yeah, of course.
It doesn't mean it's 100% like guaranteed that he's going to outperform. Of course not.
It's an edge.
But
it's,
you can still predict, like, you can still make your choice.
You can still make your choice, but in hockey, with hockey conversation especially, people have said this about the Kings all year in our inbox, whenever I've been like, hey, I think that team's imposing, right? Well, goaltending. And then you see it unfold and it's like the Canucks had one quality chance in 60 minutes.
No, again,
you know?
I think in a one round like if you're just looking at one round, it's even more magnified because there's so much more volatility, right? So if you're just saying...
Yeah, yeah, but even across the whole playoffs.
But if you're just trying to say, like, you know, if your argument is the Canucks would be heavy favorites against the Kings because of Demko, that's not fair because there is so much volatility in a seven-game series. But I think if you're evaluating a team as a Stanley Cup contender,
the sample gets
a lot larger.
They would be narrowly favored, I think.
I think they'd be narrowly favored, yeah. But I don't think it would be like, oh, L.A. doesn't have a chance because of this discrepancy in goal.
I think it'd be like minus 130, plus 120 sort of split, like pretty close to a pick'em. Canucks would have home ice advantage whenever they meet.
I did just want to read this text, and you know, Dom was weighing in on the value on Pettersson's deal and a win for the team, but not necessarily like a massive, like, wow, I can't believe they got him at that number here. This text came in. Drantz always says a player's least valuable when he signs a new contract. How much value has Elias Pettersson lost at this moment? And I think that's a really interesting way to evaluate the contract. Because I don't know if he's lost any value.
No.
You know what I mean? And I like even when JT Miller's contract looks great right now, but it was undeniable that it became much harder to trade JT Miller once he signed that deal than before he was on that deal. Bo Horvat. Probably be a lot harder to move Bo Horvat now than it was for the Canucks. Well,
you wouldn't
and to get that kind of return.
Straight up would not get the same return.
Exactly, right?
And like, and by the way, that's true for Miller too.
Exactly. That's a thing that happens. You sign the big new contract and all of a sudden teams are like, oh, I don't know. There's a lot of risk on that. I'm not sure I want to go out and get this. I don't think that's happened with Elias Pettersson here at all. And I think that's a really interesting metric of how valuable he is as a player and how fair the contract is that if and for whatever nightmare scenario you were like, oh boy, we got to make this deal, you would still be able to get a haul for Elias Pettersson.
The key is the expiry date, too, right? If it expires when a guy's 33, that feels a lot different, than a contract that expires when a guy's in his late 30s, a la Horvat Miller. So, you know, that's key. Just to come back to the goalies really quick, I just want to say this. There's this idea in, like, the NBA with the best player, like, you can't win a championship if that guy's your best player,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's sort of like the dividing line between the fifth and sixth best player in the league, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of the question that'll be like around the Boston Celtics. Can you win the championship with Jason Tatum? Just like it was around Nikola Jokic heading into the NBA Finals last year. In football, you have the same thing, right? You can't win a quarterback. That's the sort of quarterback you can't win a Super Bowl with.
Mm-hmm.
In baseball, you have it with like a whole variety of different things, right? But rotation in particular, you can't win a World Series with that as your starting rotation. And for the most part, those rules are true. But in hockey, I guess where it's different, where I think we're missing the boat in overestimating our ability to predict goalies is like what you're trying to say, or what I'm hearing in your argument here is like you can't win a cup with Cam Talbot.
Oh no, I'm not saying you can't win a cup with Cam Talbot. Okay. I'm just saying it presents risk.
For sure.
Right? I'm just saying you can't just, you're right that we overrate the difference, but that doesn't mean there's no difference and that we can't meaningfully analyze and try to quantify the difference. You know what I mean?
You're just probably wrong.
you could get it wrong, but I don't, if anybody's out there saying, like, we've seen Darcy Kemper win
Jordan,
the cup,
Binnington.
Right? Like Aiden Hill, who played really well, but came out of nowhere. I think if anyone's trying to make that argument hockey, like, come on.
There's like 65 goalies in the world, all of whom you could say, you know, as opposed to there being like five NBA players who could be the best player on the
championship. No, but I just don't
think it's... There's like 65 guys
who you could say. But then I don't think take the leap from that to throw goaltending out when you're trying to analyze a team's chances to win the Stanley Cup.
You know what I mean? Yeah, no, fair enough.
That's where I would stop short. It's like you would still rather have the goalie with the extensive track record of being really good.
I'd rather have the freshest goalie.
That's fair, too.
I'd rather have the guy who's the 20th best goalie in the league who's played 30 games than the fifth best goalie in the league who's played 65.
That's a very fair way of analyzing it. But that also, like, that actually reinforces my point, which are, there are meaningful differences
of course.
In goaltending performance, right, in the playoffs. And you can factor that into your analysis and your prediction.
It's the position that most shapes outcomes and the one that we're sort of the most lost at assuming we know much about in terms of projecting future performance. It's wild.
Yeah. But trust me, I'm not saying that Cam Talbot presents like a fatal flaw to the Kings' chances, but it's just like the Canucks have risks associated with them, the Oilers, every team has risks and potential downsides, and goaltending can be one for a team. That's all I'm saying, right? You can't just say, oh, goalie's voodoo, so, hey, it won't come back to bite them, because it easily could come back to bite them at some point.
Absolutely. But
you know what I mean?
You're also going to see a variety of Vezina caliber goaltenders fall flat.
100%.
Right off the bat, like in the first round.
Having a good goalie is no assurance, I should say, that they're going to be spectacular in the playoffs. We'll take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Lots of questions coming in. You mentioned Jake Guentzel earlier in the show. Some interesting reporting, and I mean, with a disastrous weekend and stretch of games here for Pittsburgh, it seems like the writing is on the wall as it pertains to Jake Guentzel's future and his likelihood of being moved by Friday's deadline. So we can explore that idea a little bit from a Canucks perspective, what the Penguins might be looking for, what the Canucks might want to give up, how Guentzel would fit into the salary cap picture and all of that. We can talk about the game yesterday, more trade deadline tidbits as well. We'll do the whiteboard at 1:30 in the final segment of the show. More Canucks talk coming up here. Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com.
You starting to get sick of this track yet?
No, not really. Are you?
I feel vibing to it. I feel chained to it. Producer Dom is so
disgusted.
Upset.
He loves
He's
it.
Like, this track's a banger.
This is his favorite thing. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So we've barely talked about it, but the Canucks beat the Ducks 2-1 yesterday in Anaheim. And I believe I called it a snooze fest off the top of the show.
Perfectly accurate. So, I'm kind of, this is one of those games that I'm of two minds on, right? Because on the one hand, I think there's been a sense internally for the Canucks that one of the reasons they've hit a bit of a skid here, one of the reasons a skid was probably a little bit inevitable, is that some of the hyper-disciplined buy-in from their top players in terms of playing within the team structure and doing some of those staples that Rick Tocchet likes to talk about had slipped. And not just over the course of this losing streak, but maybe for like a month, had sort of begun to list a little bit, and that this was a product of that. And I think from that perspective, last night was like a really good performance from the Canucks.
Yeah, there was no out of structure or any of that thing. Now,
manage the game, eliminate suspense, win narrowly but convincingly.
How much credit does that get you when it's against the Ducks, right? I guess that would be my only caveat, and I'm not trying to say...
I might say you get more credit for doing it against the Ducks.
Why? Because you're not tempted to just go out there and be the Globetrotters against a garbage team?
100%.
That's an interesting take.
100%. Yeah. I'd say the Sunday afternoon game after your star player signs an extension, it's like, let's just get through tonight and go get a green light on Newport Beach.
Yeah.
Like, that's an easy game to not show up for, you know, in my view.
But
I really like Newport Beach. favorite place on the
planet. But it was a very, I would say, like a workmanlike effort by the Canucks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're solidly in control, no danger, no threat that they were going to lose it, really.
So from that perspective, which, by the way, has lingered or has loomed large in the thinking about this team internally, I think you'd look at that game and say, that's how we want to play. That's a good confidence builder that our style will work. Ahead of a pair of crucial games to finish this road trip against the Kings and the Golden Knights. On the other hand, two goals, and aside from the Phil DiGiuseppe breakaway, I wouldn't say it was like a difficult night for Lucas Dostal, right? Like, I've seen some talk that's like, Dostal will rob anybody. You saw him against New Jersey. And it's like, yeah, that was an unbelievable performance in which he was threatened and had a very difficult night and somehow withstood, you know, the siege. What Kevin Woodley would say, stopping bullets with your teeth. The Canucks didn't put the Ducks under that level of duress by any means. Not even close. I thought there was maybe four really good Canucks scoring chances in the entire game. One was the Mikheyev miss, the DiGiuseppe breakaway, and then the Garland goal, a beauty, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hoglander goal, also a beauty. Man, that Quinn Hughes deke, so sick.
That was awesome.
This is a team that has scored 9 5-on-5 goals across their last 7 games now, right? And I want to note, this isn't me cherry-picking something during a run or a downturn in fortune. Like, this team has been scoring 5 goals a game at 5-on-5 earlier in the season. I was like, I'm not sure they're generating enough. So this, for me, is like a long-standing concern about this team. And I do think we saw it again. And I thought we saw it again, too, with a team that took a very different approach from the one we usually see teams take in attacking the Canucks. Usually teams are trying to punish the Canucks forecheck, or on the forecheck. They're trying to test Vancouver's defense to see if they can move the puck ably enough. And the Ducks,
against heavy pressure, yeah.
And the Ducks trapped it up. The Ducks did the NFL equivalent of rushing forward. Like, they dropped everyone into coverage, and they did so even while trailing late in the game. I mean, it was weird.
It was super weird. I got the vibe that, like, their coach Cronin is so disgusted with them defensively and knows there's no stakes to the season that he was like, even though it's not situationally appropriate, we're just going to keep working on defense. You know what I mean? It's like how, like, pitchers in spring training, it's like, I'm just going to throw my curveball today because that's what I'm working on. And even doesn't matter what the count is, doesn't matter what the score is, I'm just working on this one thing. I feel like Cronin was just like, yeah, I know we need a goal, but no, stay in the neutral zone trap. Do it until we learn it for next year, basically.
That might have been part of it. I think he was just coaching to cover. Like, he was like, if we can keep this to be a one goal game, if we can prevent the Canucks from generating anything off the rush, maybe we get a shot to tie late. And by the way, they did. Like, it worked. I actually liked the structure that the Ducks played with, given how massively overmanned they were without McTavish or Leo Carlson or any talented players aside from Troy Terry, Alex Killorn, and my guy Olin Zellweger, looking great last night, by the way. Minchukov too. But this was like, Ross Johnston was in the lineup. I was like, oh my God, Ross Johnston's in the lineup. I don't know if that means anything to anyone else, but that's like an Islanders enforcer from a decade ago. Like, I was honestly blown away. I couldn't believe it when Shorty was like, and Ross Johnston puts, I was like, what is happening in 2024? So anyway, I felt like they were just coaching to cover, and it mostly worked. I liked the Ducks' discipline. I still can't quit the Ducks.
Yeah, I know. You're talking yourself in.
Oh, yeah. I already have. Now they're playing with structure, and they'll add McTavish, Gauthier, and Carlson to the lineup next year. Like, you know, to the moon, Anaheim Ducks. Me saying it for the fourth straight year and ending up with egg on my face. Anyway, so from that perspective, I still thought, you know, I saw some people saying stuff like it was a dominant Canucks performance. And for me, it was like a clean Canucks performance. Mm-hmm. Their defense was great. They overwhelmed the Ducks with their two-way game.
It was dominant in terms of puck possession, but not necessarily in terms of high-danger scoring chances, which is what you want the puck possession to turn into, ultimately, right?
Well, and come playoff time, like, if you can't outscore, if you can't score 5-on-5, or if you have trouble scoring 5-on-5, you're dead in the water in the playoffs because the whistles go away. You're going to have bad things happen to you, right? You need to have the ability to, you know, lose 2 in a row and then put the third game to bed early, or fall behind in a crucial game 6, but have enough that you can still threaten 5-on-5. And, you know, this team's just not translating zone time into scoring chances at a high enough clip. And when they're of late, you know, we haven't seen many of those deflection goals. We haven't seen many of those screen goals. We haven't seen, like, all of those goals that were staples for this team, to the point that people started saying things like, well, you know, they just wait for their shooting opportunities and stuff like this. Like, once those dry up, what are this team's answers? And I think we are beginning to see that, you know, maybe there aren't enough of them, which, by the way, this is one good thing about covering this regime. I'll have some issue. I'll be like, oh man, I'm not sure that this team does this well enough. And then I'll start digging into, like, what should I expect about the team ahead of the trade deadline? And the team's working on it. You know, they're like, hey, we really think we need another forward who can score.
Well, but it's interesting,
and that's
too
positive.
And we
to
can
me
get it. We can bridge this to the Guentzel conversation in a second. But because
that's what I was trying
I think
to
you're
do
right. I know, but I want to make a point because I think you're right. Like, they didn't generate a ton of good scoring chances, really good scoring chances last night in that game, and it's, you know, something we've seen, but I do wonder how much of it is personnel and how much of it is tactical to a certain point. Because I, like, we've heard Rick Tocchet speak about, you know, screens, deflections, those layered deflections, right?
Yep.
Getting traffic in front of the net. And I thought last night, even more noticeable than a lot of other games for the Canucks, they were hunting that, right? Like a lot of shots from far out with guys looking for tips, with kind of traffic in front of the net. Like, but you know, when it's not working, it's just not dangerous shots then, right? You know, you don't get the tip and it just goes right into the goalie. And I do wonder if, you know, maybe even yesterday, as you said, like they're trying to get back to their staples. Was there an even greater emphasis on that type of offense? But it's not as if we haven't seen, you know, JT Miller and Elias Pettersson drive high danger scoring chances when they're on the ice in the past, right? Like they are capable of doing it. So I do wonder how much of it is personnel and how much of it is a tactical emphasis from the coaching staff of this is how we want to generate scoring chances, right? We want it to be a lot of tips, a lot of deflections, a lot of screens. Now, could that be something that is internally addressed by the team as well, in addition to the personnel side of it, right?
Typically, though, when you're generating looks, even low danger looks at a high volume, what are you also doing? You're putting the defense in a reactive position that tends to pull them apart, that then sets up the skilled stuff, you know what I mean, from high danger score, some of those mid-range scoring opportunities. Especially when the Hughes-Hronek pair is not on the ice, those are just absent. And so I have no problem with that being a functional part of your game plan. I think JT Miller is one of the best I've ever seen shooting into traffic in terms of like knowing that a goalie has to look around a body. So if the puck is going short side, they won't see it at the precise moment that he lets a wrist shot go. Stuff like that. He's genius level at it. So I don't have a problem with that as a first option tactical priority for the team. The thing is that if it doesn't contribute to volume in general, then that's an execution issue. Then that's a performance issue,
yeah,
as opposed to a tactical one.
Well, but it
like
could
I
be...
guarantee you, Rick Tocchet, it's not like, hey, let's sacrifice high quality looks
for sure
these ones.
But I think also, if your personnel isn't executing the tactical plan you've laid out, right, you can work on them to execute better. But sometimes you also have to fit your tactics to the personnel, right?
Right.
So I'm not saying, like, throw it out. That's, as you said, it's totally fair for that to be a point of emphasis for your team. But I do wonder if there's maybe just a little bit of tweaking into, like, the types of shots and their game plan of the offensive zone that could happen too.
Yeah, and to bring this back to last night's game and to drive the conversation into the Guentzel thing, I mean, one thing that was notable was, look, that becomes a two-goal lead pretty fast if Ilya Mikheyev finishes a glorious rush chance, you know. This team, one of their issues has been that sort of Mikheyev struggles, you know, and the fact that Elias Lindholm hasn't stuck in the top six, right, have caused Pew Suter and Nils Höglander to get bumped up the lineup, weakening their bottom six, and they're still sort of seeking answers at the top of their lineup. I mean, after maybe the best month of his career in terms of his two-way contributions, Miller plays with Mikheyev last night in Anaheim, and that line gets like didn't have a great game. They were the quietest line on the ice. So there's a quandary to be solved there still in the Canucks top six, and I think that's definitely where the team's priority is leading into the deadline, which brings us to Guentzel.
I'll share some reporting from your Athletic colleague, Pierre LeBrun, who says the sense is that the Penguins, after that road trip, have a very clear sense of what needs to be done before Friday's deadline, basically saying they see the writing on the wall. They're not making a push for the playoffs. They're going to sell. He says they're charting a course accordingly, exploring all options with view to bolster the club for the future. Hearing there are 6+ legit suitors for Guentzel, Vegas and Vancouver among them. So 6+, but the only two named are Vegas and Vancouver. Also reporting from 32 Thoughts today, big trade deadline preview edition, Elliot Friedman saying Pittsburgh not interested in picks for Guentzel, more interested young players, prospects that could potentially step in as early as next year to help that team.
So there's a lot to unpack here. First off, I think it would be hubris, especially at this time of the year, to describe like Lekkerimäki, Volander, and, to my surprise, by the way, defenseman Elias Pettersson as untouchable. but they're next to it. Like, this organization has very, very little appetite to trade any of their top three prospects.
Untouchable adjacent?
I don't know. I'm just trying to be dramatic. The club values them heavily and doesn't want to part with them to bolster this team's Stanley Cup chances. Not that they won't, just that they really, 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 really don't want to and don't intend to ahead of the deadline. The 2025 first is an interesting one to me. I think the club's got a sense that this isn't necessarily the right time to be sitting on the sidelines at the first round of the NHL draft in consecutive years. So I sense some pretty significant organizational reluctance
especially
to part with that asset.
They don't have the second this year either, right? So that's a bunch of your highest value draft picks in a row that you're sitting out if you give that first.
Well, and you know, when does that most likely surface, right? The top 60 picks can hit in 2 or 3 years. I mean, you know, the Stankoven pick in 2020, by 2024, it's like he might be a game breaker for them in the playoffs. No one will be surprised if he is, right? So 3-4 years down the line, well, Pettersson and Hughes are still going to be in their 20s. You know, you do have to be mindful of that. And I think the Canucks are. So that sort of leaves you with roster players and, you know, your Pod Colson, Raw 2 class guys. You know, guys that, by the way, the organization is also pretty reluctant to move because they think they're going to need them next year, given, you know, the Pettersson contract, the probability that this team retains Hronek, right? Plus their desire, I'm sure, to extend the likes of, you know, Dakota Joshua, Tyler Myers, some of the other pieces, glue guys that are expiring beyond this year. Now, given what Vancouver wants to hold firm to and given what I'm hearing from the organization, like, my sense of it is that we should expect the club to be more likely to land mid-range targets ahead of the March 8 NHL
as opposed
trade
to
deadline.
Jake Guentzel.
As opposed to the biggest fish in the pond at the moment, which is Jake Guentzel. Which isn't to say that Guentzel wouldn't deeply move Canucks management. We know that he would. They're familiar with the player, high regard for him. I'm sure they're going to do what they can. Especially given that some of the other most aggressive bidders are among their most likely playoff opponents. Although Mark Spector noting that he doesn't expect the Edmonton Oilers to be all in on Jake Guentzel necessarily, which seems odd to me given that you want prospects, you want Holloway, Broberg, aged guys. The Oilers have a ton of them that they could spend. It's my belief that Edmonton will not be able to match the best offer for Guentzel. Likely Vegas, notes Mark Spector. You never know, but I'm expecting Holland to shop from the rest of the market and still have plenty of choice. What I'm hearing is those mid-range targets remain more likely for Vancouver, where you get a little bit creative, you don't part with something that, you know, really hurts you, and you find one of those top six guys. Now, to bring this back to Guentzel, Friedman's reporting on the Penguins not wanting draft picks actually makes a ton of sense when you consider the 7-year deal Kyle Dubas signed, right? When you consider the Carlson deal and sort of the logic of what they're trying to do there, which is kick the door open for a few years on Crosby, and then reset the decks so that we don't go through a decade of pain seeking to build the next great Penguins team. But for now, we still want to be a great team if possible. They've obviously fallen well short of that with this weekend sort of putting an exclamation mark on the disappointment of this Penguins season. That loss to the Flames was just galling.
Not good.
Oh, anyway. Now, Guentzel, from Vancouver's perspective, I think would be a guy they'd be interested in extending, right? I don't think they'd view it as a short-term piece, but if you think about what are Pittsburgh's priorities going to be, what does it really tell you about them not wanting like late first-round picks, especially given that they didn't trade their first for the benefit of this team? You know, for all that they did this offseason, all the free agents they signed, like, they made that pick at, what, 11 or 12? Right after Zach Benson went, so 13. 12?
13, I think, yeah. Nate Danielson, right?
No,
Jaeger. Braden Jaeger.
Braden Jaeger.
Yeah.
So they made their first. So I don't think it's that they don't value firsts. I think they just don't care about late 20s firsts that have a low probability of yielding them the upside they need to get to where they want to go next season, right? What sort of sticks in my mind when I think about the prospect of, like, what could Vancouver offer the Penguins that no one else could, right? Like, Can you beat a Holloway-Broberg package from Edmonton unless you're trading Volander and Lekkerimäki? Like, the answer's no. Can you beat a Brendan Brisson, you know, Lucas Cormier offer from Vegas if you're not trading Volander and Lekkerimäki? Well, maybe you only have to trade one of them in that case. But, I still think there's reasons for a team that's in a bit of a win-now posture to be like, hey, we'd rather have the guys we know can play for us next year with upside. Where I think it, like, the one thing that I can't sort of shake here is the roster player side of this, right?
So Hoglander.
Hoglander.
I guess Puck Holzen now is a roster player.
Sure, but.
But, you know, he's right on that line, well, prospect,
and,
roster player.
And his American League statistics aren't at a level where you'd expect a relatively progressive GM like Dubas to necessarily, like, he'd have to really like Puck Holzen, see, like, a reason to bet on him being an outlier, despite the fact that he's kind of been only okay, you know?
Statistically, at the AHL level, yeah.
I think in every level, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he hasn't lit the world on fire in the American League level. So, you know, you're probably looking, like, I still think he's a safe bet to be, like, a bottom six guy. But that upside, I think, is more in doubt. Ilya Mikheyev, I think, is an interesting one, right? This is an interesting one that the club has to balance. The club remains very high on this player, but I do think there's an understanding that he's not performing, obviously, that his confidence
isn't high.
It would
be pretty hard not to have that understanding at this point.
They know the score, right? They know he's struggling. They know his confidence is low. And look, I think there's an understanding, too, that given the severity of the ACL surgery that the surgery to repair a torn ACL that he underwent, just over 12 months ago, it's not a shock that he's had a statistical hit to his production and performance. The organization's aware of that. I think they're still really high on what Mikheyev can bring to this team going forward. I think that sentiment's shared pretty widely around the league. I think there's a growing awareness when you talk to executives about how long it can take to recover from these particular types of knee surgeries. So how win now a mode is the team in? I think that's a really interesting thing that the club is consciously balancing.
If Ilya Mikheyev, as much as you might be high on the player, but if Ilya Mikheyev is helping you get a guy who moves the needle, not that he would be like Mikheyev for Gensel straight up, of course it wouldn't be, but like if Mikheyev is not just make weight as salary, but if he's actually something the other team is valuing and helping you bring in a player, it doesn't really matter how much you value the player. You kind of have to do it. Like, it actually reminds me a lot of the Andre Kuzmenko situation, where it was, if you find another team that values him, not only are you acquiring a good player, potentially, but you're solving an issue in your lineup right now in Andre Kuzmenko. And Ilya Mikheyev is an issue in their lineup right now. He is.
Well, except that Kuzmenko wasn't a guy you could play low down the lineup.
Sure. Mikheyev, at least you have the option of stashing him on the fourth line. And he's not going to hurt you there.
And I think the organization felt like they were getting out of a deal that they might have had to pay to get off of. In the future, there was at least a possibility that his form would continue to atrophy, especially under Tocchet, and, you know, that you'd end up holding the bag. I don't think you're feeling that way about Mikheyev, because Mikheyev's size and defensive game is still highly regarded. Now, we bring up Mikheyev, but you know who barely made an effort to try and keep Mikheyev while he was the general manager in Toronto and Mikheyev was an expiring unrestricted free agent?
Kyle Dubas.
Okay, so that seems unrealistic. Unlikely. Garland?
Yeah.
Now, here's one that, like, everyone knows how I feel about Connor Garland as a player. I think he's awesome. I actually think he's capable of doing more than the Canucks have given him a shot to do over the course of this year. The thing is, though, and like as I'm sort of thinking through this, Garland has 2 years a term. You okay, bud?
Dom's talking in my ear about nonsense. We'll get to it in a second. Stay on your roll. The Broncos just released Russell Wilson, and Dom's threatening to hit a breaking news.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday.
No, hit it. Hit it.
Oh, whatever. We knew it was going to happen.
Hit it. Hit the breaking news. Russell Wilson's...
We're all on... There we go.
Sportsnet 650, breaking news.
Yes, Russell Wilson is on the market. He's been released by the Denver Broncos, as we all knew was going to happen.
At the cost of $85 million in dead cap space for the Broncos. Russell Wilson deserves this, by the way, even on Vancouver radio ahead of the trade deadline, because he remains one of the most iconic athletes in the history of Pacific Northwest sports. He's going to go into the Football Hall of Fame. His tenure in Denver been a disaster.
What? You're really going in on this.
Worst buyout, Russell Wilson or OEL?
Oh, Russell Wilson by a mile, $85 million in dead cap space. My goodness. This is one of the worst trades in the history of the NFL, but Russell Wilson still brought a lot of happy memories to a lot of fans in this city. He's been bought out. He's on the market. Congratulations on working with Arthur Smith, Russell Wilson. What were we talking about?
We were talking about Connor Garland to the Penguins.
Well, I just think so if you're Pittsburgh, and I'm just trying to feel my way through this. This isn't based on any inside intel aside from the stuff that was inside intel was presented ahead of time. This is just me thinking my way through it. If you're the Penguins and your goal is to be good in the short term, and part of that has to be weighed in moving on from Jake Guentzel, because guess what? Once you trade Jake Guentzel, you don't have him, and that's a big loss. Mm-hmm. Well, Garland has 2 years left at $5 million. The Canucks might not see him as a top six guy, but might a progressive general manager with like Dubas, who's a little more data-driven.
And I think you've said in the past that Garland is a divisive player around the league,
right,
which sounds negative, but the flip side of it is that there are some teams that really, really value him.
Really like him.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if the Penguins would be one of them. And then I think about this. The club's still waiting to make a decision on Phil Kessel, right? And when Kessel first arrived in Vancouver on February 13th with grainy photos of him at YVR, we all thought, like, hey, doesn't that feel like a redundant piece given that they have Hoglander and Garland in their bottom six? Well, what if the answer is just yes?
That it would be redundant, except if, I mean, Hoglander's already in the top six now.
Yeah, but also
could you use Connor Garland as a trade chip?
Now, I don't know that that makes you better because I think
it's a big piece to take out of your lineup.
A huge piece.
And if you're, like, I get it.
The driver of their most consistent 5-on-5 line.
If you're thinking Phil Kessel is going to come in and even give you 90% of what Connor Garland has this year, like, oof, that's a massive gamble.
He might give you 90% of the offense, but he's definitely not giving you 90% of the two-way value. So, look, just a thing I was thinking through here, but I think the Pittsburgh thing is fascinating. Especially when you go through the thought exercise of trying to help them short term, it really reorients how you look at the possibility of a trade deadline deal. And I'm pretty sure the Guentzel deal ultimately is going to look very different from the classic, like, player prospect first structure that, like, the Lindholm trade had or the Monahan trade
had. It's interesting, too, because even, you know, as it says, oh, they're interested in picks, or they're not interested in first-round picks, they're more in players and prospects. The funny thing is the Canucks' best prospects aren't exactly knocking on the door of the NHL in Lekaramäki and Vilander, right? Those aren't guys that you bring in where it's like, okay, they're a top prospect who's going to step into our lineup next year and help us win. They're guys that need a little bit more development. So even that, I mean, would they, like, how much, I guess at a certain point, the upside on somebody far away from the NHL starts to sway Pittsburgh, but how much would those guys even move the needle for the Penguins is an interesting question. And then I think you get into the, you know, Podkolzin, Hoglander looms really large in this for me as a guy on a cheap contract next year who's got 19 goals this year. I think that's a really fascinating one. And then Garland, and, you know, Garland, Mikheyev, pieces like that. I think the question for me there, if you're moving a Connor Garland and you're moving Garland and that's all you're moving from your roster, you're getting back Jake Guentzel, it feels like you still have to make another move to help shore up your forward group.
But also, it wouldn't just be one for one. You'd have to still be.
Right. But if that's all from this roster. Yeah. Futures. Yeah. Sure. But I just mean just that from the roster. And then you bring in Phil Kessel. I just still feel like you need to go out and then do like Jordan Greenway or something else on top of that to give yourself that depth of forward again. You know what I mean? It feels like, I don't know how much the marginal value is. And I love Jake Guentzel as a player to justify doing that when you're throwing futures on top of it. But we'll see. Look,
it's a really hard one to sort of weight or handicap in terms of where the value would be in something like that. But more than anything, just a thought exercise.
It's an interesting one.
That as you're thinking about Guentzel and you're thinking about the prospect of the Canucks landing him, I'm sure they'll check in. They definitely love the player. I do expect mid-range deals to be more realistic for them. And when you think about what it could look like, Pittsburgh's just such a wild card.
Well, and I do think creativity is kind of going to be the key word here for the Canucks, right? Given their salary cap situation, they've already moved their first. They're very, very reluctant to part with their top prospects in a deal, but they also want to go out and try to really find somebody who's going to make a difference, you know, somebody beyond depth. Maybe it's just mid-range, but not just pure depth. Doing all of that with the constraints they have, that requires creativity. So that's going to be something to keep an eye on here as we get closer to the March 8th trade deadline on Friday. Final segment of the show coming up. We'll do the whiteboard. We can take some of your texts as well. It is Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.